upgrade your tool storage for the new year with help from Menards. For heavy-duty storage that protects your tools, choose MasterForce. From shelving units to cabinets and so much more, you can keep your tools safe and within reach. Get versatile and durable storage from MasterForce today. Check out all our MasterForce storage in-store or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome back to That's Politics, where I break down the news you've heard recently to its bare bones. I'm your host, Mackenzie Atkinson, and this is part two of my DEI breakdown. Today, we are going to be diving into teaching DEI concepts in the classroom. Back in February, I worked with one of my classmates, Marie Spencer, on a story about the changes in the DEI policy at Western Carolina University. This is where the inspiration and much of the information comes from for this episode. Marie and I's original reporting was very surface level and straight to the point. I'll have the story linked on the podcast website for you to read. But I want to take a deeper dive into this topic. Last week, we talked about DEI in general and the partisan perspectives of it. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, pause this episode and go back and listen. But either way, here's a quick recap of the last episode so that we're all on the same page. 1. DEI is very complicated and the parameters of what counts as DEI is not clearly defined. 2. President Trump has signed 2 executive orders rolling back DEI policies in the federal government. He has expressed goals of rolling them back even further. 3. Quotas and affirmative action, which are ways that DEI was carried out, have been deemed unconstitutional through various Supreme Court cases. Lastly, 4, the average conservative views diversity as a good thing, but they do not want DEI prescribed to them. Now that we have a generalized recap of what we talked about last episode, let's take a closer look at DEI and take a peek inside college classrooms. Now, things are changing very quickly when it comes to DEI concepts and the allowance of them being taught in classrooms. Just a few weeks ago, I graduated from WCU, and during my last semester, there were letters sent out by the University of North Carolina system and the Department of Education. The letter from the UNC system, commonly referred to as the February 5th memo, was a letter to all chancellors and provosts throughout the university system informing them about adherence to the January 21st executive order. The letter expressed commitment to abide by state and federal law prohibiting discrimination. This memo addresses universities and faculty members working with government entities. I linked to this memo on the podcast website so you can see what I'm looking at. In a nutshell, this memo stated that if an institution or faculty member wants to work with the federal government on research or receive funds for their research, they must adhere to the January 21st executive order. The letter clarified that, quote, compliance with these requirements will largely be left up to the federal agency with which the university seeks to contract, unquote. The second half of the letter said that course requirements that fall under DEI may disqualify them from government contracts. This brought up a question of what courses would be considered DEI. This letter said, quote, effective immediately, all general education requirements and major specific requirements mandating completion of course credits related to diversity, equity, and inclusion, or any other topic identified in Section 7 of the Equality Policy, are suspended, unquote. Now, this statement seems very final. No DEI in classrooms, period. Now, I looked into Section 7 of the Equality Policy for the UNC system. It is a neutrality policy stating that no employer or employment position, quote, shall be organized, be operated, speak on behalf of the university, or contract with third parties to provide training or consulting services regarding matters of contemporary political debate or social action, unquote. This is a fancy way of saying no political activity or activism on behalf of the university, which is fairly normal, but this now groups DEI in as political activism. Nothing at WCU changed. When I was doing the research for the story, I talked with a faculty member on background, and there was some speculation on if there were titles of courses that were subject to change because they contained the term diversity in the section header. But as of the end of May, no changes were implemented to adhere to the January 21st executive order or the February 5th memo because Western said that they were already in compliance. I mentioned a letter from the Department of Education earlier. This letter is commonly referred as the Dear Colleague Letter. I'll also have this linked on the podcast website so you can also follow along. This letter works in conjunction with the February 5th memo. This letter was sent out February 14th by Craig Traynor, the Acting Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights in the U.S. Department of Education. This letter expressed the belief that DEI is discriminatory and that universities have an obligation to non-discrimination. In the letter, Traynor states that American institutions have been discriminating against white and Asian students and that these institutions utilize race-based preferences. He even goes as far to say that institutions are encouraging segregation on campuses. That doesn't make any sense to me. Traynor does not provide evidence to support these claims within the letter. I see that there are footnotes on the letter, but none of them are about the claims of discrimination on campuses. So I did my homework. The claim that stuck out to me the most was that universities were discriminating against white and Asian students. I found a study written by Joshua Grossman, Sabina Tompkins, Lindsay Page, and Sherrod Goel titled The Disparate Impacts of College Admissions Policies on Asian American Applicants. The study looks at Ivy League Plus schools. They do not define what an Ivy League Plus school means, but there are 11 schools included, and they may include Brown, Columbia, Cornell, Dartmouth, Harvard, UPenn, Princeton, Yale, MIT, Duke, Stanford, and Northwestern. The researchers found that Asian American students were less likely to attend one of the Ivy League schools. To quote the study directly, it said, quote, "We find that Asian American applicants to Ivy 11 schools ultimately attended one of these schools at consistently lower rates than white applicants with comparable test scores," unquote. They did not pinpoint DEI or affirmative action as a cause for this, as they would expect to see Asian American student attendance to increase, not decrease, which was the case for the study. They also included in the study that legacy applicants were twice as likely to get admitted to one of the Ivy 11 schools. Remember last episode when I talked about how minorities were excluded from industries and settings? The same thing is said about academic settings. That's why HBCUs exist. Now think about who is a legacy to these Ivy League schools. Typically, they are white, Christian, and upper class. So it is safe to assume that white legacy students are twice as likely to attend Ivy League schools compared to Asian American applicants. The claim about schools encouraging students to segregate on campuses was a weird one to me. I talked with my dad to get a starting point for my research. On a phone call, he said that universities were hosting exclusive ceremonies for minority groups. When looking into this claim, I found an article from the Washington Times that talked about Columbia University hosting official commencement ceremonies for minority groups. There were 6 different ceremonies designated for each group if they wished to participate. From my perspective, this is making a mountain out of a molehill. It is a basic inflammatory claim. These were elective ceremonies that students could participate in if they wish. It is groups celebrating together, not forcing them to segregate. Adam Harp in the last episode made a good point that birds of a feather fly together. This practice has been called, or dubbed, neo-segregation. It is very similar to de facto segregation. This is when segregation is not explicitly enforced through legal mandates, but rather through choices from individuals and institutions. It's kind of like when groups are choosing to live in certain areas, etc. This theory does not account for socioeconomic status. These exclusive ceremonies, in my opinion, is not segregation. It is making these minority groups more visible to the public by giving them their own ceremony to celebrate together. And again, it is completely optional for the students. I find that many political talking points are just claims and statements without anything to back them up. It honestly is infuriating and was littered throughout this entire letter. Now turning back to the content of the Dear Colleague letter, they continue on in the letter to say that the Department of Education intends to take appropriate measures to assess compliance with the January 21st executive order. This was sent out before President Trump signed an executive order starting the dismantling of the Department of Education. So we'll see where it goes from here. But all of this, the February 5th memo and the Dear Colleague letter, just to say that DEI in schools is bad and that those course concepts should not be taught. We touched on this last week about how broad of a concept DEI is. It could include race, gender, sexual orientation, disability, and socioeconomic background. now they are claiming that teaching these concepts in courses is bad, but teaching these topics is important for societal growth. When searching for sources to speak on this topic for the story, not just the episode, many people were apprehensive about talking about DEI concepts. I found a source through one of my fellow journalism students for the story. She is an adjunct professor, which distances her a bit from academia. Just a little background, tenure track professors who are working their way to tenure, which is kind of like a promotion, are subject to probationary periods where they are careful about speaking out. This makes them very apprehensive to talk about hot topics such as DEI. Think back to Section 7 of the UNC Equality Policy. They don't want to act in violation of this policy. Adjunct professors are part-time and typically work in another industry which serves as their main source of income. For example, when I took an individual rights law course, my instructor was a practicing lawyer and then taught courses in the evenings after he was out of court. My source is the same way. So without further ado, let's get into the interview. We have Caroline Pendry, an adjunct sociology professor at WCU, here to give us an inside perspective of college classrooms. So tell us a little bit about what you teach and why you teach it.
So I've taught intro to sociology, and right now I'm teaching two sections of social problems. So mostly what I go through in my course is studying social problems that have like objective realities to them and empirical data. So that means like we're not just, there's no subjective topics that we're talking about, right? And that means that there is data to support people's like mental or physical suffering in the world. And we're studying the institutions that may contribute to that, but may also be solutions to those like problems that we're talking about. In the broadest sense, we study social institutions and the role that they play in social problems. So that could be policies and government, and then also like how does like race, class, gender, how do things like that, how do they interplay with those policies?
How do you approach this concept in the classroom when it comes to like teaching it to students for the first time? Like this is their first time connecting all of these ideas together.
Okay, so I think that teaching DEI is confusing because we aren't necessarily teaching DEI, like, or what is diversity, equity, and inclusion. So that is a set of like practices, and it was a framework that academia and corporations and all kinds of like groups were using to try to offset structural inequalities or barriers that people were experiencing. So it was an attempt to solve some of the social problems that people were experiencing over the past, you know, like, I mean, more than decades, right? And so I don't teach this is what DEI is, but I did bring it into the class in terms of it's a current topic, right? Like there was an executive order that came out and that directly impacts our conversations that we're having in a social problems class about race inequality, about LGBTQ inequality, about gender inequality, ableism and disability. So it kind of isn't just like people think it sometimes it's just about race or it's just about gender, but it's not. Diversity, equity, and inclusion is supposed to be much broader in that sense. So I'm not teaching this is what the policy is, but my topics in class tie directly back to those policies and the conversation that's happening at the federal level.
Have you received like any criticism about what you teach from like an outside perspective? Not from within academia, maybe even from like a student who's like, I don't agree with this, but like, do you receive any criticism about teaching these topics?
Not that I am aware of, right? But I think also because I sit in that adjunct kind of thing that I kind of dip my toes in and I kind of dip back out, right? I don't feel like I'm getting pressure or criticism necessarily. I think, you know, there's this question about fear, right? Do people feel afraid? And when I think about it, it's like, I don't feel afraid necessarily that I'm going to get like fired or not get my job back, right? But that there's a little fear that it's a slippery slope. And because there's so much confusion, we're not really sure what we can and can't talk about or what does this even mean? Kind of like the, you know, when the executive order first came down and departments and the federal level were taking like photos and content down off of websites and everything that had to do with people of color and women, the Tuskegee Airmen thing, which then there was a bunch of backlash and it was just like, people were like, well, that's, it's Black people, you know, like surely that's diversity and inclusion. We need to take it out. And then they reinstated it because there's just no clear cut lines about it. And I think what the fear is for me is that we might not be able to talk about things in the future, right? Mm-hmm. Like book bans. They come out and starts like this censorship kind of thing. And so some of my fear or whatever is less about, am I going to get fired? But what happens when we can't talk about these things, when we start censoring ourselves? These are important topics and we can't just pretend that, you know, race inequality doesn't exist, right? Because if that's what not talking about DEI means, then I think sociology as a field is going to have a hard time. I think a lot of fields, the education department is going to have a lot of hard time talking about things if we can't talk about disability or ableism, right? Because that's included in DEI. It's not often thought of, right? Mm-hmm. But that's the inclusive part, right?
Yeah, totally. So, because I ended up like doing some research trying to find a conservative perspective for this podcast. Mm. And I was like, oh, Western had a Turning Point USA group. Where are they at? They've been unregistered as an RSO. Oh. So we no longer have like a conservative group. But I ended up going to their like official website and they have a woke professors watch board and they label professors and like you can click on them and see like profiles like, oh, where do they teach? What do they teach? Why are they woke? And I'm like, that's crazy.
That's right.
That you're like targeting these people because of what they teach.
I think that's an important thing I kind of took a note of too, which is I try as hard as I can when I'm talking about topics that have been politicized or that seem sensitive and trying to stay as apolitical as possible and go back to like roots of academia, which are like, what does the data say? What is the empirical evidence, right? Mm-hmm. The textbooks, all the research that's been done about inequality, and then all the progress that has been made at corporations and in education that where they have DEI policies, right? Well, we made it all the, I work in corporate America. And so sometimes it's like, all they're doing is like making a concerted effort to consider different applicants or different points of view when you're in a meeting or when you're designing software or you're designing a building that you're thinking about, well, how are people with disabilities going to interact with the space? How are people of color going to interact? I know Google had a thing about their video conferencing software like Google Meet, and they actually like built in certain capabilities with the contrasting for people of color. And like that was about DEI. That was about being inclusive and how lighting works and how your camera works and with the software. And so that's what DEI is trying to do, is include people, right?
I didn't even think about, like, that's not something that I would consider or like even think about. Huh. Okay. Hey, I learned something new today. Yeah. No,
there was something else I wanted to point out too, was just like the kind of line for the executive order versus how it affects Western Carolina. And so DEI, when the executive order came out, it was about you cannot have required courses or required content that is labeled DEI for graduation, right? And Western did all the analysis and said, well, we don't have required content, or I know the sociology program doesn't have required content for that. And so there are a couple of courses, I think, that they're trying to either shift the content or at least give another option to students, or that it requires the chancellor's kind of like waiver or oversight, something like that. But I thought it was interesting too. It's like they're trying to put a box around what it is and what we can and can't do. And knowing that they've determined that this is not a concern because it's not a requirement made me also feel a little more confident talking about topics like this in class.
Why are talking about DEI topics important for societal growth?
So my favorite thing to talk about in sociology is the systems approach versus individuals, right? So we're not psychology, we're sociology. So we're looking at institutions and how they influence behavior, mental health even, your lived experience. So we talk about it in the ways that like institutions influence individuals, but not necessarily getting into the nitty gritty of like a psychology kind of perspective. So one good example to talk about systems approach versus the individual approach is looking at someone who might be struggling, who is living in poverty, on welfare, and who has just been laid off from their job, or, you know, looking at the Midwest where tons of factories were shut down, right? And poverty just like ensued in those like places, right? Yeah. And so if we're just looking at the individual, then it's like, why can't you get a job? Or the fact that many people who are in poverty or who are on welfare actually do have jobs and sometimes have two or three jobs. And so if you're limiting the conversation to why don't they have a job or why aren't they making enough money, then we miss all understanding the root of all these other problems that might be affecting them, like globalization, right? Or a decline in unions. The fact that trades and tariffs, right, and all of those and how they impact how they impact wages, how they impact how corporations behave and how they treat their people. Talking about if we zoom out and look at all these other structural things that are going on, right? So using the same example with manufacturing and factories moving to other countries. Well, that depressed lots of places, and those were not individual like problems. They felt individual, but they're connected to a broader like theme, which is I don't want to pretend to be an expert on any of the like the policies like NAFTA or whatever that caused it, right? But it was that, you know, legislation gets passed that makes it easier for corporations to move their production elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So that can depress wages. And there's a decline in unions, which those like protect the workers, right? Mm-hmm. So that they can have better wages. But by looking at those broader things, then we can have like bigger solutions. We can have better solutions. We can more clearly understand the root cause of why unemployment exists or why poverty is existing or why a lack of education is a problem in one area or why people lack access to healthcare, right? Why don't you just get health insurance? Well, there's a whole broader set of like social forces that are moving around that individual that we can change, right? And so if we can make a positive change at a structural level, then the idea is that it will carry on and have a broader impact to all kinds of people, right?
Okay. What do students get out of a class geared toward understanding the challenges that minorities and society faces as a result of these policy changes and government decisions?
The hope and the goal is that students leave not just with like a better understanding mm-hmm. of the challenges that people may face as a result of policy, but that they can make different decisions moving forward with it, that they can influence future policy, or that they can have different like forms of like empathy, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about the sociological imagination, and that gets like, you know, sociology nerdy on you, and I don't want to go too far on that. But really the point is like, if we can step outside of ourselves and step outside of what we think are individual problems and look at things as a whole and more holistically, then not only can we come up with better solutions, but we can have more empathy for each other mm-hmm. and we can impact change, right? Like that's sort of the like touchy-feely hope and dreams of like sociology. And I feel like that exists a lot in a social problems class mm-hmm. because that's the topic. But I think it's also worth noting that not all sociology is the quote unquote, using my air quotes, woke discipline, right? There are fields and there are academics in that realm that don't have the same kind of perspective on, you know, social movements and social change and, mm-hmm. and how to fix the problems of the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get it. So when we talked before recording this, you talked about how all things interconnect. It's a big mm-hmm. web and they all touch each other. In political science, we call that intersectionality.
Same.
Okay, so we got some crossover here.
Sociologists, yeah.
So how does race, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera, intersect with each other in the sociology field in a way that you frame it in your public issues class?
So in the social problems class, I just had them do a very, like, I was very excited about this exercise. Related to intersectionality is also this idea of matrix of domination, which is a little bit more of a structural view of it. So intersectionality, sometimes we talk about more in terms of like how people feel it. So like, I feel it because based on my identities, right? I am a white woman, lesbian of a middle to whatever class, right? Mm-hmm. And so I occupy one space of privilege in that I am white and that I have an upper class, but I don't occupy spaces of privilege when it comes to being a woman or being a lesbian. Right. Mm-hmm. And so intersectionality in terms of like how I experience the world is like I occupy these different kind of spaces. But anyway, our matrix of domination exercise was interesting. So I listed out all the topics that we talked about in class. Like, we've talked about race already. We've talked about class and poverty and gender and LGBTQ inequality and disability and ableism. And so I had the students do like an exercise of like connect these dots. So it's okay. Well, people of color are more likely to be in poverty. Mm-hmm. And people in poverty might also experience more disabilities because of nutrition or whatever. When we think about LGBTQ rights, we're also talking about women's rights. Because we talk a lot about like bodily autonomy, right? And there's policy about those, about reproductive rights. There's policies about trans access to medication. And so if there are policies passed that don't allow treatment for trans people, then it's that slippery slope again of if we don't have bodily autonomy as a woman, then those same arguments get made for trans people. And so things connect very quickly, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not like you only have white people who are trans, right? And you have people of color who are trans. You have them from like different socioeconomic statuses and backgrounds. And all of these things kind of work together or against each other, depending on the views. And in that exercise, I also had them talk about how do we help solve some of these social problems? Like, what can we do? Mm-hmm. And I was trying to paint the picture of like by making a change and fighting for one thing, like if you're fighting for women's rights, then you're by de facto fighting for trans rights in some ways. If you're fighting for welfare reform and like how to like our housing, what is that? Like affordable housing.
Yeah.
You take on affordable housing, then you aren't just talking about people in poverty. You're talking about mostly people of color, mm-hmm. right? Or a lot of the LGBTQ population or trans population that tend to have less access to jobs sometimes because of discrimination. So fighting for one sort of social problem or issue and trying to make one issue better, you can also impact change and issue for better or positive impact in other areas as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's been kind of like a thing where academia is like the foundation of democracy and like education is the foundation of it.
Mm-hmm. I just thought about this the other day.
And if you control what is being taught, you're diminishing that democracy. And if you take away talking about these issues, the issues will never be solved or even addressed.
Well, that's the systems approach again, too, right?
Yeah.
If we can't look at these problems critically or these topics critically, then we can't change anything, right? Mm-hmm. But yes, that whole education is like the foundation of democracy, which is why we have it and why we have mass education and it's compulsory because the idea is that we have a educated like populace to elect, you know, representatives. You hit on something, though, about education, which is that maybe less so in higher ed, there's a lot more like freedom mm-hmm. of topics and conversation and being critical. But I think in high school and below, there is not the same level of opportunity and freedom to frame things in a way that could be seen as politicizing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at its root, in some ways, education has been and is one of the jobs is to like teach is to socialize people, right?
Yeah.
It's to socialize us into the society and the culture that we live in.
The things that you teach are highly politicized. So how do you go about managing that polarization in a classroom setting so where people can get everything out of it without the political lens being involved?
Stay data driven. Stay like empirical. And it's like, this is the text. These are the like references. This is the data and the information that's coming out there. I've also kind of said a blanket kind of, basically I told the students,
cross your T's, dot your I's.
Yeah. Well, when I started the class, when on the first day too, I said, there will be a lot of news articles to read too, because a lot of social problems and things that are happening, we want to keep it current. We want to keep the conversation relevant. I don't want to talk about social problems from 10 years ago. I want to talk about them like now. So I include a lot of online articles, like news articles too. And I'm like, it is very hard nowadays to find a true, pure, centrist, like journalistic article. And that we have to use our brains and be critical here when we read them. And just know that I'm doing my best to find something that I can that is as centered as possible, that's giving the facts. It might lean left, it might lean right, whatever. You can also bring articles. I'm happy to like bring those in if we find like reputable sources. But it's like, we need to exercise our adult academic brains where we look at things with a critical eye. And what I mean by that is take things with a grain of salt, knowing where it's coming from and not reacting to some of the politicizing or inflammatory language or things that are extremist kind of languages mm-hmm. and words that people are using. I'm sure you understand that as like a journalism person,
yeah,
trying
definitely.
To like stay like as centered as possible. And I think that's what I'm trying to like temper the political aspect of the course content by just showing and staying more into like, these are like facts. Mm-hmm. These are things that we see in data. We know that people of color live many, many years, like fewer years than white people. That is a fact. That,
yeah,
there is something, there are social trends going on with that, that require like looking at.
How are you handling the changing policy landscape in your classroom?
Cautiously.
Tiptoeing?
I'm not tiptoeing. So I'm staying up to date. I'm trying to track things that are coming through. I read my emails right when Western sends something that says, you know, here's an update. Here's our findings or our stance from the DEI order, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I've had conversations with the department head. I've had conversations with a close mentor about how they're navigating it or things that they're concerned about. I'm trying to keep things clean and above water or above board. And like I said, apolitical as possible without sacrificing the sort of educational content and the aspects that I want them to leave the class knowing, right? Just because there's this, you know, we can't have DEI as a required course to graduate doesn't mean that they are changing the content or pushing us to change the content in a sociological setting. Because like I said, if we can't talk about race or gender at all, and that's not what they're saying in DEI right now, but if it goes into that, then that's going to be a totally different conversation. So I'm keeping with my topics. I'm choosing things that I still think are important to know. But I think that trying my best to stay as apolitical or as verbal and definitely trying to like not bring in my own like personal like bias, right?
Yeah.
'Cause we've all got it. I mean, and that's part of this whole idea too, is that we like look critically at ourselves. Is this my own bias? Okay, maybe it is. Maybe it isn't.
Yeah.
But trying to neutralize that as much as possible.
Yeah. And I ended up finding out about you and your course through one of my peers. Mm-hmm. And she had said, like, she's in your
social problems, right?
The social problems class. And she said that you kind of rushed to the LGBTQ section because you didn't know if you were going to talk about it. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
I made the comment about a specific day about talking about trans rights. Mm-hmm. So I was using specifically the idea or the debate around trans athletes. And I was using that as an example of a moral panic. And we talk about moral panics, which is, you know, sort of this disproportionate response to something seen as a threat. And, you know, when you look at the numbers of the actual number of like trans athletes, and that sometimes these conversations are distractions from larger social problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I use trans athletes as like an example, as like a use case, a case study mm-hmm. on talking about moral panics. And so, yeah, I felt like I was talking a little more about trans than I normally would, because, right, it's just that same reaction of like, are we overcompensating and giving an amount of like time and content relative to other things? But anyway, yes, I made the comment of I kind of wanted to get through it because it was less about that like fear of retaliation, but it, again, that slippery slope of like book bans, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're not regulating what we or how professors talk about this content in class at this time. But that fear was, who knows what it's going to be like in 5 years and what that censorship might look like.
And that's scary to think about from an academic and educational standpoint.
Yeah, it is. It is. And like, yeah, it was the fear, again, less of like, I'm going to get fired, and more of, we won't be able to talk about it, because that's what's happening with when you start seeing all the like erasing things on websites, mm-hmm. it's they're going to, you know, start regulating and censoring other topics of conversation in class. I did spend the full week on LGBTQ issues. I over-rotated a little probably on trans,
yeah,
because I felt like the moral panic conversation was important, and I felt like the trans topic was also important and was a really good example of all these, like, all the tenets of a moral panic and how it applies to a social problem, because it's like we've spent millions of dollars and people have spent a lot of time talking about trans athletes, and relative to, okay, well, what about like the number of people we have living in poverty? What about the like maternal mortality rate that we have? Mm-hmm. We're like 53rd in maternal mortality rate. Right. So what about like a healthcare crisis that we have? These are big conversations that would impact, you know, a lot of people that are huge social problems. And some people are arguing that a social problem is that we have, you know, trans athletes.
Are professors fearful of their positions in regard to teaching DEI content?
So again, I didn't want to speak for other professors.
Yeah.
Right. And my relationship with the university or with the institution in general is a little weaker than your average professor. But when I was thinking about that question, I was thinking that really it seems like the vibe has shifted, that the atmosphere has changed a little. It doesn't necessarily mean that a lot of behavior has changed or that I hear about a lot of fear, or like I feel a lot of fear. But this, like, I wrote down like the cloud of hesitation, right? Mm. That it's kind of there, and there might be like second guessing or being more cautious and careful. And maybe there's nothing wrong with being a little bit more thoughtful about how you're framing things.
Mm-hmm.
But there definitely has been sort of like a shift. Like I said, I think it's an important topic. I wanted to do it for that reason. I wanted to do it because if we let the fear and the concern win, you know,
yeah,
we silence ourselves too much and can't have, even now, like with the Reddit thing with anonymity, if we can't have face-to-face conversations or have public discourse, then we're all missing out. Both sides, everybody's missing out. If you cannot, and that's how we've ended up in such extreme polarization now, is that there's no giving on either side. And we've got to be able to find a path back to it.
We will try.
Finding a path back to it. So, yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Caroline, for coming in and talking to us a little bit about sociology and how that is related to DEI, especially through your course. Thank you so much.
DEI concepts are very important to talk about in classroom settings. I'm specifically talking about in higher education. K-12 education, specifically high school education, should give students a basic historical understanding of diversity and oppression, but not go into correcting these systemic issues. Higher education is where you learn how to better the world ahead of you. If we do not include diversity, if we do not acknowledge the systemic shortcomings and the oppression, then we are not going to better the society that we live in. Shutting down DEI programs just sweeps the problem under a partisan rug. We need to be able to talk about these issues without using it as a weapon against minority groups. So this is where academic freedom comes into play, but we will save that for the next episode. Thank you for tuning in this week to That's Politics, where we talked about DEI concepts being taught in the classroom. For a list of sources for this episode, visit the website at thatspoliticspodcast.com. Come back next week where we will break down academic freedom. I'm Mackenzie Atkinson, and I'll see you next time.